Disobedient Obedience. The sixth talk in a series on the Sermon on the Mount was presented by Ron Julian on August 8, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are in week six of our study in the Sermon on the Mount. We'll be starting with Matthew 5:27 today. This section of the Sermon on the Mount is often called the antitheses. Jesus keeps repeating this phrase, you have heard it said something, but I say to you something else. Last week, I just talked briefly about what I think Jesus is not doing and what he is doing in this section. Two things he is not doing, I think. He is not contradicting the Old Testament. He is not setting out to say, let me show you how inadequate the Old Testament was, and I've come along to make it much better. And secondly, this is a little harder to explain, and hopefully this will come out again here today, but I think that Jesus is not merely trying to show us that we cannot keep the law. I mean, this is the way I used to think about this section. The idea here is to drive home how high God's moral standards are such that we see that it's impossible for us to keep them. It's not that that isn't a part of what he's doing, and in fact, today we're going to see something that I think where that clearly, I can't believe that it is not a part of what it is that he's trying to do. But I think there is another sort of primary purpose to this section. Jesus is correcting the misuse of the law by the Pharisees. The Pharisees would say, look, I haven't murdered anyone, I haven't committed adultery, I've kept my vows to the Lord, and so on. And then they would argue that they had fulfilled the righteous requirement of the law. But Jesus is saying that what God wants is something deeper. It is more a matter of the heart. The key thing, I think, is this. Jesus is not just accusing the Pharisees of being sinners. He's not just saying, you know, I know that you Pharisees have been given it a real hard try and you're really devoted to God and you've tried to get up there and do what ought to be done, but I have to tell you, it has to be even better than that, guys. You know, I hate to tell you the bad news. You've done such a good job, but it's just, you know, got to do better. That's not it. He is accusing them of being unbelieving rebels against God. They're not just sinners, but they are hostile to God, and they are hiding their disobedient hearts behind a facade of keeping the law. That's what this is about. When he said, starting this out, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees, what he's saying, I am arguing, is their righteousness is a pseudo-righteousness. It sort of looks like righteousness because they keep saying, see, I've kept all the rules. But in fact, that's not what they're about, and you don't want to be like them. So that's what I think is going on, and maybe that will, but hopefully by the time we get done today, that will be clear. We're just going to look through several of these today, and then we'll finish it up next week, the antitheses. Let's start in 5:27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Okay, this is a very famous statement. In my lifetime, even a candidate for president admitted to committing adultery in his heart. This is Jesus' second example we see here of how our righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees. We can't think of ourselves as living out a life that is characterized by the righteousness of God just because we have never committed the act of adultery. Now, many have said about this, and I totally agree, that Jesus is bringing the 10th commandment to bear on the 7th. The 7th commandment, depending on how you count, actually I think for the Lutherans in the crowd, you actually count these different than I have been taught too. So sixth or seventh, depending on how you look at it, says, you shall not commit adultery. The tenth commandment says, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So the seventh commandment is prohibiting the immoral breakage of the marriage bond. In marriage, a man and woman have pledged to have physical intimacy only with each other. They are keeping themselves for each other. For either party to have a sexual relationship with someone else is adulterating the relationship. I mean, we use that word to adulterate something means to put stuff in there that doesn't belong. You know, it is sullying the purity of it. So the adulterer has brought someone into what is supposed to be a mutually exclusive intimacy that doesn't belong there. And in doing so, has been unfaithful to his or her spouse. Okay, now, at another time, we might talk about a biblical view of sexuality and why God forbids adultery and why God has various standards for our sexual behavior. You know, why not have sex with whomever we please, whenever we please? That's not where we're going to go today, because that's not really the focus of this passage. The wrongness of adultery is not really in question. The Pharisees agreed, at least in theory, that adultery was an evil and that they should not commit adultery. So Jesus is not trying to convince them that adultery is somehow something that ought to be avoided. They would agree with him about that. But that's where the 10th commandment comes into this. Not only are we not supposed to commit adultery, we are not supposed to covet our neighbor's wife. We're not supposed to want to commit adultery. Not only are we not supposed to steal, we are not supposed to covet our neighbor's goods, his house and his stuff. I'm not supposed to want to take what my neighbor has. And some other things as well. So we need to clarify what that means, because I think this is very much related to what Jesus is talking about here. So let's talk about coveting first for a second, which is not necessarily always so easy to figure out exactly what's going on with that. When I first encountered that and people told me what the Ten Commandments were, I don't think I really understood what that was saying. I mean, what is it asking of me? Is it saying, I shouldn't want anything? I should not have any desires? That seemed not only a high standard, but kind of a strange standard and a foolish standard in a sense. If we think about desire, God has designed us in such a way that we are made to have desires of various sort. And the desires themselves, it seems to me, there's nothing wrong with those desires. I would take an obvious example. I'm really hungry, and somebody goes by. I haven't eaten for days, and I'm really hungry, and somebody walks by eating this really great-looking, you know, sandwich. You know, it's a Philly cheesesteak sandwich or something, and it goes by and I haven't eaten for days. Of course I want it. I mean, I have this desire for that sandwich. That's not what the 10th commandment is talking about, I would argue. That is a natural thing to have happen. I think it would be impossible for any human being not to feel desire in that situation. Coveting is talking about something bigger and more fundamental. As I would understand it, that what is being forbidden in the 10th commandment is for me to nurture in my heart the thought that I should have these things. I'm going to nurture this resentment against my neighbor for having what I do not have. And implicit in that is I'm nurturing this resentment against God that he hasn't made my life such that I have that thing that this other person has. I think about myself having those things. I think I ought to have those things, fostering in myself more and more desire and less contentment with what God has actually given me. I think that's the kind of thing that the 10th commandment is talking about. Well, I think this is exactly the kind of thing that Jesus is getting at when he, in 5:28 here, As I said, I think the issue is not desire. Sometimes I think people put an even harder burden on themselves than what Jesus intended here. He is not calling it a sin to feel sexual desire. We are sexual beings. We cannot help having sexual feelings and sexual desires. The sin is in feeding that desire, giving myself over to that desire, taking in my mind what does not belong to me. Even though I know that this woman is not for me, I'm going to go there anyway in my mind. That's the sort of thing that he's talking about, which in essence is coveting my neighbor's wife. I mean, it's what Jesus is saying here is really no different than what the Old Testament said. So in my heart, I'm running after that which God has forbidden me. Now, let me be frank about the situation here. Not that frank, but a little frank. Sexuality is a unique part of human experience. I can't think of anything else like it. The pleasures that we seek in sexuality are generated in our very own bodies. It's like growing up and discovering that we have our very own heroin factory in our body. If we all could produce heroin just by thinking about the right things, every one of us would be in danger of being heroin addicts, because it's just there. It's just ready to be called upon at a moment's notice. And so the nature of sexuality provides a powerful incentive for us to grab for things in our minds that we should not have. That's why pornography is such a powerful problem. We can degrade ourselves in private without ever actually crossing the line into actual adultery. We can acknowledge that it is wrong for us to have any other sexual relationship apart from in marriage, and yet give ourselves over to having those relationships in our minds and bodies. So in doing so, I would say we are coveting. That is, we are in our minds saying, I will not submit to the limits that God has placed. All right, I won't go there, but inside I'm going to go there, even though that's not where I should be. So I think that's why this is a powerful thing for us to deal with. I mean, each of us has experienced the power of our own sexuality and how difficult it is to sort that out. Now, okay, so let me bring another issue in here. There's another well-known passage in the New Testament that talks about coveting. This is the famous passage in Romans 7, where Paul says, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. For apart from the law, sin is dead. And I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin became alive, and I died. And this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me. For sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through it killed me." Now, I'm not going to go into all the ins and outs of that passage, but a very famous passage where Paul describes himself as a prisoner of sin. What he does not want to do, he does. What he does want to do, he does not do. And if I'm understanding what he's getting at here, he's describing this commandment against coveting as the one that really brought home to him how big a hold sin had in his life. He could keep himself from stealing and committing adultery, but he could not keep himself from nurturing the desire for things that did not belong to him. So that description in Romans 7 is that classic description of coming up against the real intent of the law and discovering the depths of my own sin. That's exactly what Paul is describing in Romans 7, is coming up against. When when the commandment came home to him, I think is what he's saying, he realized how much he was acting from inside in a way that was not in keeping with what he wanted to do. So it's interesting then that at least in this passage where Jesus is saying, if you look on a woman to lust for her, you're committing adultery in your heart already, it's very easy for us to connect in our minds what Paul says about coveting. It's that same kind of experience. And it's partly because of that that I'm inclined to think that certainly Jesus at least partly intends in this passage for us to go to that very place, to realize the depths of the problem of sin that we have. His warning against committing adultery in our hearts hits most of us very hard. As I say, even presidential candidates feel the force of it. That's Jimmy Carter, if you don't remember. So in this case, I do agree that part of Jesus' purpose is to show us our need for God's mercy. That is, we need to confront the reality, the seriousness of the problem. But, like I have been saying, I think Jesus has a more fundamental purpose that fits each of the antitheses, and I think it's true for this one as well. Remember, Paul used that language, when the commandment came, sin became alive and I died. And at least, now I can't remember, Jack used to argue on that when the commandment came was when it came home to Paul, when he realized what it was that it was asking for. I thought that was good. I don't know if Jack still thinks that anymore, but that I think that's what he's talking about. So he's talking about here confronting the reality of his own sin when it really came home to him what this commandment was asking for. Well, I think Jesus is implying that the force of the Ten Commandment the Tenth Commandment has not come home to the Pharisees. They would point to the fact that they do not commit physical adultery as evidence of their righteousness. And yet, it hasn't really sunk in with them that they are in rebellion against that commandment in their heart and basically specifically violating in their own souls the Tenth Commandment against coveting. In other words, they are covetous people, nursing the lust within them even as they keep their public behavior pure. To exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees, we must start with acknowledging what true righteousness is like. The true problem of the Pharisees is that they insist that they're righteous men. So you see what I'm saying? Yes, when it comes home to me, what Jesus is saying here, this is an application of the commandment not to covet, and I realize what that's about, yes, I confront the reality of my own sin and my need for mercy, but there's an even more fundamental step that has to happen first, the step that the Pharisees have not taken, which is to acknowledge, yes, in fact, that's what it's supposed to look like. The Pharisees have put the emphasis on their outward behavior. I haven't had adultery with anyone, and so they haven't really had the opportunity yet to confront the reality of their sin because they're thinking, well, I'm doing fine. And I think that's, if anything, Jesus kind of has a two-part thing in mind here. But the first step has to be acknowledging that this is what God is all about, that that's what righteousness would be. And now we can talk about where do I stand in relationship to that righteousness. But first, you've got to admit that you're not as good as you think you are. And then we can deal with that. Okay. So, Jesus goes on to say, "And if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to go into hell." Now, as far as I know, very few Christians take this as literal advice. And I think I have good empirical evidence for that as I look around. And as it happens, I think this is wise. If cutting off parts of me could actually solve the problem of sin, I would be constantly whittling away at myself until there was nothing left, right? I mean, that's not the way you're going to solve the problem. But just because Jesus is not speaking literally does not mean he is saying nothing. I mean, he means something very serious here. And I think what makes sense to me is he's relying on think about you feel how you feel about your hand. Of course you're going to keep it. You don't want to cut it off and throw it away. It's ridiculous to think of something like that. But he's saying if you could solve the problem of sin, it would be worth it. So I think what Jesus is getting at is in the lives that we are living, we are called upon to have a ruthless attitude toward those things that draw us away from God. I am to take seriously what Jesus is saying here and say, yes, that's right. That's the way it ought to be. And to the extent that there's a part of my life that's going the other way, I say, well, even though it may be something I really want, I need to get rid of it. Pursuing righteousness is more important than whatever else I might retain in this life. If I'm going to take God seriously, then I must embrace his perspective on the things in my life. I have to be willing to abandon the things that may be dear to me if they are in fact against the will of God. And we have to keep up the fight against those things. So I think that's why he brings this in at this point, is he says, I'm serious about this stuff. You got to look yourself right in the face and say, what are you about? What's going on here? The Pharisees presented themselves as those who did not commit adultery, but they were willing to admit that they cherished the pleasures of adultery in their hearts. And more importantly for us, are we willing to admit that? That's the place it starts. Are we willing to acknowledge, yeah, that's a problem. That's not just, oh, you know, human nature, that's the way we are. No, there's something there that needs to be confronted. Okay, then Jesus goes on in verse 31, and it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Okay, you notice adultery here is the topic again. I think this is kind of joined with the other one. These are two ways in which the Pharisees end up condoning what is wrong with adultery, even while they seem to be meeting the requirement of the law. Okay, now let me just be upfront here. The topic of divorce is a difficult one. There are difficult biblical interpretation issues with this topic, and there are difficulties just facing in the world that we live in. It hasn't always been the case, but divorce is so prevalent in our society that there's hardly one of us that hasn't been touched by divorce in one way or another. So it's a sensitive topic, it's a difficult topic, and I just want to say right up front that some of those interpretive issues I'm still wrestling with myself. There's one word in this passage that provides so much field for thought that David Crabtree wrote his master's thesis on that word. Got himself in a lot of trouble, too. And I haven't actually written a master's thesis on that word. I read David's a long time ago. So there are a lot of questions here. So I want to make some points, some assertions and some semi-assertions about what's going on here and try to put this in the context of what it is that Jesus is trying to get at, like the other antitheses. Okay, so point number one, simple one. In the Old Testament, there is a verse that seems to allow for divorce. That's Deuteronomy 24. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies, who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Okay, now, this particular command is, it's about something specific. It's not a general statement about divorce. It's setting up this thing. Okay, she divorces, married somebody else, then she divorces him. Can she go back to the first guy? Which is occasionally happens, but that's not the typical problem that we have with divorce. And I would argue that there's something about that. The commandment there is not just a moral issue, but there's something in the covenant, something ritual about this prohibition at that spot. No, you can't do it that way. It wasn't prohibited for the divorce the first time. It wasn't even prohibited to have the divorce the second time, but it was prohibited for her to go back to the first husband, which I think is, as I would understand it, is a specific part of that covenant that God made with Israel for specific teaching purposes that he has in mind there. Okay, but we do have this thing about giving a certificate of divorce. And at the time of Jesus, there was a debate amongst the various rabbis and teachers as to what this law implied and allowed. And there were the kind of the strict interpretations and the lenient interpretation. So among the Pharisees, some of the Pharisees had the more lenient view that this basically allowed a man to give a certificate of divorce if his wife was displeasing to him for pretty much any reason that he'd come up with. And there's some debate about this tricky phrase. It says, because of some indecency. It's actually not real clear exactly what that phrase is getting at. So I'm sure there was a lot of debate about what was happening there. So that's the situation. There was this command which seems to allow for the husband to give a certificate of divorce if he's displeased with his wife. My second point, Jesus sees this as a kind of loophole to allow a man to commit adultery. And this is in keeping with what we've been seeing with all of these antitheses. So if I'm married and I go sleep with someone else, I have committed adultery. But if I'm married and I give a certificate of divorce to my wife and then I go sleep with someone else, I'm legal. Because the law said you could give a certificate of divorce. I'm a righteous man because I followed the rules. So I've arrived at the same goal. I want a different woman from my wife. I just used a kind of a legal loophole to get there. But that makes me a righteous man because I followed the law. My third point, in another passage, Jesus said that the original commandment was given by Moses because of the hardness of your hearts. Just because Moses allowed for a certificate of divorce doesn't mean that divorce was a righteous thing to do. Yes, there are times when a marriage is broken. Perhaps the other person has been unfaithful, gone off with someone else. There is a legal provision for bringing that marriage to an end. But that doesn't mean that God wants marriages to end that way. It's not like God is saying, you get married, see if it works out. If it doesn't work out, then dump her and go find somebody else. I don't believe that Jesus is saying that Moses in the Old Testament was wrong to have allowed this. This is not something that Moses made up on his own and Jesus is saying, no, he made a mistake. I mean, it's always true. Marriages fall apart. And you have some provision for dealing with the fact that a marriage falls apart. What Jesus is disagreeing with is those Pharisees who interpret this as saying that I could dump my wife and still be a righteous man because of Deuteronomy 24. That says, I'm unhappy with my wife, I dump her, go get somebody else, I'm good. He's saying, no, you're not. Okay. I'm not sure I'm going to make my point number four because I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, what I was going to talk about is this, it's this exception clause, except for the cause of unchastity. You know, we talk about how there are certain topics that have brought, you know, terrible consequences to the forests around the world because of all of the stuff that's been written about them. This is one of those phrases that has killed whole forests because of all the stuff that has been written about it. Okay, so never let the fact that you don't know what you're talking about keep you from talking. So I think I'll make this point anyway. Okay, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure about this. This is tricky, but it is possible if you look at the way this phrase is used in the couple of places that Jesus uses it, that what he's getting at is he's not saying, let me give you the exception that makes it okay for you to divorce, so much as what he is saying is, since a marriage is intended by God to be together and exclusive to those two people, you bring another person into it through whatever means, and the marriage has been adulterated. Except if one of the spouses has already committed adultery, in which case it has not been adulterated because it's already been adulterated. There are some people who argue for that perspective, and I think it actually might make some sense. I don't want to say that that's what's going on. I'll give that to you for free, and you can think about whether maybe it makes sense. Here's the deal. What I am fairly confident of here is my point number five. Jesus is not setting up divorce as the unforgivable sin. He's speaking to the legalism of the Pharisees. They think that because they have a law allowing divorce, that they can get a new wife whenever they want. Not all the Pharisees, they want to be fair, but there's a group among the Pharisees who have this perspective. But in fact, their hearts are adulterous. They want to sleep with another woman, and they found a loophole to let them. Jesus is saying that there's no such thing as a no-fault divorce. Sin is always involved. God intends a marriage to be lasting and unstained. But because of the hardness of sin in our hearts, marriage falls apart sometimes. What we cannot do is tell ourselves that since we followed the rules of getting a certificate of divorce, this makes us righteous in divorcing. Okay, so that I think is the thing that Jesus is trying to get across. Remember, when we think about, I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot of Pharisee in all of us. And we can read the one just before this about lusting for a woman and committing adultery in your heart, realizing that we have violated this commandment in an ugly way many times in our life, and sort of say, okay, but you know, I forgive myself. Meanwhile, I know somebody who got a divorce and they're a pariah. I mean, this is the deeply disobedient person against God. I don't think there's any difference. I mean, we're talking about sin. What Jesus is concerned with is that we accept the picture of what is righteous and good from God himself and don't fight against it just so that we can justify ourselves in the way we do things. So I know that when the topic of divorce comes up, now we want to talk about, so what is allowed? Can you do this? Is it okay if you do this? What if the other person leaves? Can I get remarried again? And I'm not going to talk about that. I mean, I have what makes sense to me right now, but that's not really the focus, though, that I want to talk about today. I want us to see the kind of the common thread through each of these antitheses. There's this idea that I be willing to confront what God's righteousness really looks like and not hide behind loopholes the way the Pharisees were doing. That's really the issue. Okay, so let's look at one more. Verse 33, again you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is of evil. I make a personal comment that every time I see a picture of Jerusalem, this phrase goes through my mind. This is the city of the great king. Okay, so earlier I said that Jesus' teaching on committing adultery in the heart does in fact partly confront us with how difficult it is for us truly to be righteous. But I think I mentioned last week that here, this thing about vows shows us that that's not primarily what Jesus means to be doing in each of these antitheses, because here, it's easy. I mean, I think I could easily live a life of not making a vow of the sort that Jesus is talking about here. It's not that it's that hard to do, but what is true of this is what's been true of all of the antitheses, is there's something going on here where the Pharisees are saying, look, we've kept the law, so we're okay, even though in fact they're not. So let's explore this here a little bit. Jesus is referring to the teaching of the Old Testament on making vows, and there are various places where that language is used. Probably the clearest one for our purposes is Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. And then the passage goes on. Now, so what if you have a daughter who's under the authority of her father and she makes a stupid vow to God? Okay, so then we go on and say, all right, so if the father heard it and he didn't say anything, then she has to do it. But if the father hears it and says, that's a stupid vow, I don't want you doing that, then she doesn't have to keep the vow. And there's these various things about, you know, so when do you have to keep it or not? Most of them about daughters or wives and how they interact with that stuff. Okay. But the fundamental thing that it says is you make a vow to the Lord, putting yourself under a binding obligation. You have to do what you said you were going to do. The issue in these passages is, like I said, this idea of putting oneself under a binding obligation. And why would I do something like that? Okay, now, I think that this is the kind of situation that Jesus is really talking about here. Suppose I need something from you. I need to borrow your donkey or something. And you're reluctant to give it to me because you might not get it back. What if I just work the poor thing to death and then you never have a donkey and then you're out of luck? Okay, so I'm going to give you some collateral, but the collateral that I'm giving you in this spot is kind of my neck. I'm saying, you know, I vow before God that I will give you the donkey back. This is my vow. I will do this. May God strike me if I do not keep this vow that I'm making to you. That kind of idea. Vowing to my own harm, they sometimes describe it. Now, why do I enter into this? Because I want your donkey. And you might not give it to me if I just say, oh, I promise, I'll give it back. So if I can convince you that I have taken this very serious vow to do that, then maybe I can get you to give me the donkey. But the fact is, in that kind of situation, that sometimes things don't work out the way I would like. You know, I take the donkey, we're working out in the field, and all of a sudden it keels over dead. Now, I can't give the donkey back, because even though I promised that I would. And I can't afford, I mean, if I could afford to have a donkey, I would have gotten one for myself. So I can't afford to get a donkey and give it back to the guy anyway. So what I'd like is a vow that's strong enough to convince him to give it to me, but weak enough so that I don't end up in trouble if I don't follow through. You know, it's kind of the best of both worlds. That's what I would really like to have happen. And you don't have to take vows to the Lord to see that. I mean, we see it in human relationships, right? I can get all emotional, oh, I promise, oh, no, really, I would never do a thing like that. That's what I say now, but then later when I have to pay up, well, you're not going to be a mean guy and make me pay that back and, you know, all that. So this is a human thing. This is the kind of thing that we're inclined to really want to do. So, now, keeping the law is something very important to the Pharisees. So, keeping my vow is a very important thing to do. I want to be righteous according to the law. But the key phrase here is the phrase, to the Lord. My vow to the Lord. So, I would like to be able to have some wiggle room at the end in case this doesn't quite come out the way I want. So, what if I make a vow that's pretty impressive, but it's not quite to the Lord? I swear by heaven that I will give you the donkey back. I swear by the great city of Jerusalem that I will give you the donkey back. Then later, after the donkey's keeled over and I can't give it back, I can say to myself, well, it wasn't a vow to the Lord. It was a vow, I swore by heaven. It wasn't a vow to the Lord. So I'm okay. I'm a righteous man, because what it said was, you got to keep your vows to the Lord. The guy is out his donkey, but I'm okay with God, because the rule said that it's all right. In essence, I'm kind of using God for my own purposes. I'm sort of trying to bring him in through the back door to convince you that to give me the stuff, but I want to get off on a technicality at the end. Notice how Jesus goes on to comment on other kinds of vows. If you make an oath by heaven, well, that is the throne of God. And I think this is exactly the thing that he's talking about, is you can't just say, well, it's only technically the ones that include the phrase to the Lord in it that you have to keep. If we're really talking seriously, whatever it is you're vowing by, ultimately it takes you back to God. That this is indeed the issue, I think, becomes clearer when we look later in Matthew 23. In Matthew 23:16, Jesus says, "Woe to you blind guides," he's talking to the Pharisees here, "who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering upon it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And he who swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it." So Jesus is saying, basically, you're just playing with words and technicalities here. You made a vow, and clearly this was a vow. If you're swearing by anything that is in all connected with God, like his entire creation, then ultimately that goes back to God, and who are you fooling? So this is something like, I think, what's happening here. You want to convince someone that you will fulfill some vow in the future if only that person will do something for you now. How do you convince them? You sort of metaphorically put a gun to your head and say, if I don't bring it back, God will pull the trigger. But you want to do it in such a way that you can tell yourself that in the end, if you don't come through, you're okay as far as the law is concerned. I didn't vow to the Lord. But the whole thing is total presumption anyway. We can't really control the future. I mean, I can't promise to you that donkey will not die. I mean, I'm not God. I don't know how that's going to happen. It's evil to try to manipulate someone into giving me something by implying that God somehow compels me, and even more evil to then find a way to find a loophole at the end and say, well, he doesn't compel me actually after all. So it's a kind of a legalism. It's kind of like Simon says, oh, Simon didn't say. So it ends up, you don't have to do it. The law says vows to the Lord, so I can play this in such a way that I get what I want from you, but I can renege and still end up being okay with God. So Jesus says don't vow at all. Just say yes or no. And I think the force of that, again, is I say to my neighbor, well, yes, I will return your donkey. If you loan it to me, I will return it. I don't make this vow to God. I just say, this is what I will do. If that's not enough to convince you to give it to me, well, then I'm out of luck. I'm not going to use God to try to convince you to do this, and I'm certainly not going to try to somehow use this legal loophole to avoid the vow that I have taken on. So, again, the Pharisees can say, I always keep my vows to the Lord, just as the law says, and yet actually be untrustworthy and manipulative people. Now, just a little side comment here. We might ask why God gave these vows at all. I mean, why did he talk about making a vow to the Lord and stuff in the Old Testament? What makes sense to me right now is that it was a part of the religious life of Israel. It was really intended more for a situation like this, I think. I might make a vow like, if God gives me a child, I will dedicate him to God at the temple, or something like that. So then, if I get the child, I need to keep the vow that I made. Maybe at that point, it strikes me, gee, I'm sorry I made that vow, because here's my kid, and I'd kind of like to not dedicate him to God at the temple now. But that's where, hey, you made a vow to God, and you keep your vows. It even says that if you vow stupid things, you still have to do them. That's the thing with the daughter and the wife and stuff. If you look in there, it says, if the daughter vows some foolish thing, or the wife, I forget which one it was, but the father hears it and doesn't step in to do anything about it, then she's got to do it, even if it was dumb, because it was a vow that she made to God. So the idea is that you got to take God seriously. I mean, if for whatever reason you make some vow to God, that's not something that you do and then take back. When you make a vow, you keep that vow. Which is why you shouldn't really use it for that kind of collateral sort of thing at all, because when it's talking about whether I can predict the future or not, whether I'm going to have the money to pay back or something like that, I don't know that at all. So I'm actually being presumptuous and using God in a way that's entirely inappropriate. I'm not taking him seriously. So the kinds of vows that it was talking about, I think, can make a certain amount of sense. But what Jesus is looking at is the way the Pharisees have perverted that. And basically what he's saying, don't try to use this vow to get something from people. Just say yes or no, and then live with the consequences. All right, so as I said, I think there is at times in what Jesus is saying here some of that speaks to us about how difficult a problem the problem of sin is for us. Certainly the thing about committing adultery in your heart, many believers have come up to that place, just as Paul said about what happened to him with the idea of coveting, to realize, wow, I have a serious problem here. And the problem is not that I am a person with sexual desire, because that is not a sin. The problem is that I will take myself in my mind to places that God does not want me to go with my actions. But I'm going to say, okay, so I'll be outside, I'll say, I've kept the rules, but inside I have taken myself someplace where I ought not to go. So, yes, something like that has the power to convince us of the reality of our sin and how much we need the grace of God. But what's true of all the antitheses, I think, is this idea of Jesus, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. They describe themselves as law-keeping, but what they're really doing is they're following certain external rules and convincing you that they are therefore righteous people, even though their actual attitudes are rooted in hostility to what God really wants. So the Pharisee can say, look, the law says don't commit adultery, and I don't commit adultery. Look, The law says you can give your wife a certificate of divorce, and that's what I did. Look, the law says keep your vows to the Lord, and I always keep my vows to the Lord. But in each case, the outward conformity hides an unwillingness to actually conform to God's moral will. I don't really want the way God looks at things to be the standard that I have to live by, because it's either going to ask me to do things that I don't want to do, or it's going to confront me with the reality of my own unworthiness. And either way, I don't want to go there. That was the problem that the Pharisees had. Compliance is an inward thing. God cares about coveting and lusting in my heart as much as he cares about whether I act on those desires. Compliance means acknowledging the true intent of the law. Moses allowing divorce was not an endorsement of it, but something that was there because of the hardness of our hearts. Compliance means not interpreting the law narrowly and legalistically to get myself off the hook. God never intended to use the idea of vowing to the Lord as a legal trick to imply a promise that is stronger than you mean. Somehow I get the benefit of making a vow without the obligation of keeping it, and still I call myself a righteous person. So what Jesus is calling us to do is, unlike the Pharisees, is to look at ourselves and God's moral will straight on. Say, no, this is what I am, this is what God is calling me to. We need to acknowledge what God truly wants of us. We need to admit how far short we fall and how much we need the grace of God. And we need to pursue and fight even for what is truly righteous, which is, after all, as Jesus told us, that's the righteousness that we hunger and thirst for. Hunger and thirsting for legalism is not really what we're about. We're hungering and thirsting for the real thing. And you can't hunger and thirst for the real thing if you won't acknowledge what the real thing is, even if that reflects on you badly, and even if it calls on you to do things that you don't necessarily want to do. I had several brilliant ideas as I was walking up here as to what I wanted to say at the end that was really going to end this in a powerful way, and I've totally forgotten what they were. So I think we'll stop now for questions or comments.
When you were talking about the Pharisees and how, you know, they talk about, oh, we're following the law, so we're righteous, it kind of reminds me of, like, the concept of a book on how to be a friend or how to be a good husband and so on. It's like you can do all of the things that you have to do, so to mm-hmm. speak, like, oh, make sure you don't forget mm-hmm. Christmas and so on, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. you're not really being a friend. You're not really being someone that you love and so on.
Yes. You got the book there.
Right.
Say, oh, honey, you look very nice today. You know, that doesn't quite do it. Okay.
Yeah. Oh,
that reminded me of one of the things I wanted to say, is the fact is, okay, what we want to think about is that it's not just the requirements of the law that can be used in this way to hide. All religion can be used in this way, and Christianity can be used in this way. We in the church are inclined to do the same thing. I mean, and sometimes as an actual outright act of rebellion against God. We use, okay, so we get baptized the right way, or we keep the religious rituals of our tradition in accordance with the way they're supposed to be kept, and still have hidden from whether we are really repentant people and understood what God is really looking for. So, yeah, that was one of those things. That's important to understand. This is not a Jewish problem that we're talking about.
And then one other thing. Early in, I guess we'd say in my Christian years, I would say, oh, God, if you do this, I will do this and this and that.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
As I matured, I just realized, well, Lord, I'm being foolish by doing this because I mean, you really aren't moved by these. And I'm foolish also for making vows that I know I can't fulfill.
Yeah.
And initially caused me a lot of grief and right. so on. You know, it's like, oh, why did I do this? And so on.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if this was kind of one of the things you may have gone through. It's like it was a serious, I mean, I was serious in my heart. I mean, I really right. wanted these things. I mean, I wasn't being flippant,
mm-hmm.
but I realized later that, yeah, I can't do this.
You know, the place where I have faced that temptation is at various times in my life facing, you know, I'm not trying to manipulate other people into doing things, and I'm not really trying to manipulate God into doing something. I'm trying to manipulate myself into doing something. Exactly. And so I think if I make this vow, you know, then I will not fall into sin again because I have made this vow and I'll take it really seriously. But again, I ended up realizing I'm just trying to use God as a tool. You know, God, can I grab a hold of you and use you as a tool on myself for a while? Which was an evil thing to do, I think. So yeah, I think we need to stay away from that stuff. Damien, over here. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to see you, too. What? You look very nice today.
Thank you.
Today.
Yeah.
First of all, that was all good. I really liked everything that you said.
Thanks.
I mean, especially about the Pharisees and their true motivation for, you know, following the law and, you know, the legalism and the loopholes and everything, and that that makes a lot of sense to me. I know you said you didn't want to talk about the divorce thing, so if you can answer this question without doing that, that's fine. It touches it kind of tangentially, but
right.
I could conceive of say a situation where a person looks at these declarations that Jesus makes and is not motivated by necessarily the same intention that the Pharisees are, which is to look for the loopholes so that I can get away with it, but instead out of a real, genuine desire to be righteous and to be good, actually takes these and applies it to their own life, and as a, you know, desperately wanting to be good, desperately wanting to do the right thing. And say, like in the example of where Jesus talks about divorce, taking that statement literally true and as a universal statement, since it really sounds like a universal mm-hmm. statement, it's universal language. Or in the second example, you know, Jesus said, you know, don't make any vows, let your yes be yes mm-hmm. and your no be no.
Mm-hmm.
A person could say, okay, you know, God doesn't want me to make vows because I will have to keep them. He wants me to just always tell the truth and always
mm-hmm.
Do what I say I'm going to do. So then, in a way, they see every statement they make as kind of like a vow. You know, mm-hmm. everything I utter, I have to do that. So they become terrified or somewhat stifled by the fact that they're afraid to let anything come out of their mouth because they're going to be bound to that. Say, like, when they were a kid, they just kind of jokingly told their parents or something like that, you know, well, when I get married, I'm going to, you know, I don't know, name my first child after you or something mm-hmm. like that. And then they, you know, 20 years goes by and they get married and then they're having a child. And all of a sudden they feel like, do I have to be bound to that
mm-hmm.
thing that I said? I mean, I didn't promise it. I didn't vow it. But it says here,
mm-hmm.
let your yes be yes, mm-hmm. your no be no. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're afraid to ever say anything because they don't want to commit to something that they can't, you know, casually say something. I mean, can you address that at all or talk about that? Does that make any sense to you? Have you ever dealt with that in any way?
The second one, I can tell you what I think. If I'm being clear in my thinking about this, I think that I am not seeing that let your yes be yes and your no be no as everything that comes out of your mouth has the force of a vow. That is, sometimes I think that was my first inclination as to how to think about that is, you know, just everything that you say, you should always do. Well, I mean, it's good for me to keep my promises and stuff, but I don't think he's saying it has the force of a vow. He's actually rather backing it back and saying it is not appropriate for you to be making those kinds of vows. You need to operate on the more fundamental level of, I'm saying, yes, I will do this thing, which implies more, I will do this thing if I can. But I'm not vowing. I am not saying this commitment that I have made before God that I'm going to do this thing. Because the thing that the Pharisees are looking for is that way that they can make a vow which gives it that force. I think that is I'm looking for that thing that will make it possible, and yet I still have a way of getting out of it. So in that case, I think I need to think about the things that I say within the general moral framework of how God wants me to live. So if, as a kid, I said, you know, I'm going to name my kid after you, I think I go back to my parents and say, you know, I said that at a time when I was a kid and I didn't really know what I was talking about. I didn't understand what I was committing to. I don't think that was a good idea for me to do, and I think actually it would be better if I did this thing over here. I think we have plenty of leeway to work things out in that way. It's not like once something comes out of my mouth, it has been inscribed in stone. I mean, if I tell someone I'm going to pick you up at the airport at 12:30 and I get a flat tire and I'm not there, have I committed some cosmic error that, you know, but my words are resonating throughout the universe, 12:30, you said 12:30, you know. I don't think it's like that. I think what he's saying is, let's just back this off and deal not in terms of big vows that where you're invoking the God's punishment or something, but you just say yes and no about stuff and let it work out on that level. So that's how I think about that. The divorce one, I'm not quite sure. I may have miscommunicated there. See, I would say Jesus does mean what he's saying. I mean, it isn't possible to have a divorce that God would look at and say, yeah, that was all good. I mean, that's not... We are making a commitment to stay together and to keep our relationship pure. And Jesus is saying, the stuff in the Old Testament doesn't give you a loophole to get out of that. But, so in that sense, I should take seriously what it is that's being said there. But I do think at the same time that what I'm looking at is, it sounds strange, but it isn't any more than sin. I mean, it's just sin, you know, and we sin all the time. And not the way, but, you know, if I have come to a place where I cannot preserve my marriage, that's a bad thing. But I didn't throw away my salvation or anything. But where I would be throwing away my salvation is if I had this attitude that obviously I need to come out in the right in this stuff, so I'm going to read the rules so that it tells me that in your case you did okay. You know, now I'm hiding from the reality of my situation, and I think that's what Jesus is really concerned with. He is concerned that I pursue righteousness, so I don't blow it off, but I pursue that righteousness under the umbrella of the grace of God with a desire to understand what God wants and to try to pursue that. So... yeah, he's serious about it. I always feel like my perspective on divorce is kind of like, it makes nobody happy because it's really serious and yet it's not so serious. You know, it's not so serious in the sense that, aha, you know, that's the, you know, the scarlet A or whatever, you know, the thing that marks, now we know you're not one of us or that kind of thing. I mean, that's not what Jesus is getting at. What he's about is that willingness to see what God has called us to.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't mean to imply that it was someone who wasn't taking it seriously, but sort of like in the example of someone who is so concerned about being righteous that, like, the last part of it where it says, you know, whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Mm-hmm. So, like, if there's a guy who so wants to be righteous, so wants to be mm-hmm. good, and he's now in love with a woman, you know, and he feels that maybe God wants him to marry her, but she's been married before, and then she's been divorced. Is he committing adultery by now marrying her?
Yeah,
see, that kind
I knew,
of...
I knew you were going to go to that.
Sorry. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I don't talk about such things.
Okay.
Okay. See, this is the hardest part of it, but I think I do my perspective at this point, which is subject to correction, so don't believe this just because I'm saying it. I mean, you shouldn't do that anyway, but in particular, I'm saying right now, I'm still thinking about this, so don't, but I think what Jesus is getting at is you can't claim that this marriage has not been adulterated by a divorce and marrying someone else. I don't think that he is saying, once a divorce has happened, that now the rules say you're not allowed to get married because you would be violating the rule of adultery. I don't think that's what he's getting at. I think that what he's saying is a divorce is a break that causes, I mean, now that committed relationship is gone. And it can't help but be that if you marry someone else, you are not maintaining the relationship that you initially committed to. But does divorce really happen? Yeah, because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses said, "Okay, give her a certificate of divorce." And I mean, okay, so that's what I just said is really, really controversial. And I've gotten in a lot of trouble for saying that before from people who think I am a darned liberal for saying that that's the case, only they didn't say darned. So I want to take seriously, I mean, I don't want to water down what Jesus is saying here. I mean, we need to face into the reality of what he's saying. But in the context and the kind of thing that he's getting at, I think that there is a distinction being made between the fact that marriages fall apart and so divorces happen, but the real issue is, can you look yourself in the eye and say, okay, I did great, you know, this was great. You say, no, you can't, because that's not righteous. You can't say the law says it's okay. I think that's what he would be getting at. But it's tricky. It's very hard. And You don't want to ask me any more questions about that. That's as much as I have to say about it. I
wasn't planning on it.
No, I saw
that was good.
I saw Logan's hand go up back there.
Oh.
And I don't know what he's going to do, but I'm not going there.
Give it over to him.
Not after Logan.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I've often read this and been captivated by the statement where Jesus says, "But I say to you."
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like he's introducing a new level of personal authority to these people, because sometimes he's saying, "You got a really bizarre understanding, and I'm mm-hmm. trying to correct it."
Mm-hmm.
So, but I say mm-hmm. unto you that mm-hmm. we in the mm-hmm. Jesus of Nazareth rabbinical school interpret it this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But when he hits the thing on murder, and this is very clear in the law, and he says, "You know, don't commit adultery. That's a good thing." But I say unto you,
mm-hmm.
and he raises the ante.
Mm-hmm.
Says, you know, it says don't commit murder. That's a good thing. But I say unto you, and he raises the ante. And am I right in understanding that he is establishing a personal, subjective level of authority before these people that would make them say, holy cow, who does this guy think he is?
Okay. Somewhat. Yes and no. For instance, I mean, what we looked at today, I would argue, when he says, "I say to you," you look for a woman on a woman to lust for, you commit adultery with her in your heart. I don't think, if he was challenged on that point, say, who are you to say that that's the case? He could say at that point, I'm just talking about the 10th commandment. I mean, not coveting. This is what not coveting looks like when it comes to the issue of men and women. Okay? I think that he could argue what he says about hatred, calling person you fool and all that kind of stuff, is just the working out of the implications of the fact that these laws are rooted in those fundamental commandments to love your neighbor as yourself and love God with all your heart, soul, and strength. So it's not subjective in the sense that he's coming along and saying, nobody would have ever known that this was the case if I hadn't come along and said it. It's brand new. It's not new. It's what's always been there in that sense. Not that Jesus couldn't come along and do something like that in the upper room when he says, a new commandment I give to you. I think the implication of that is, I am giving you, this is a new thing that I am giving you here in some sense. But the people do end up responding to Jesus by saying, wow, this guy teaches with authority and not like our scribes and so forth. There are two things we could point to. Some of it, he really does bring himself in. I mean, what he said just before this was outrageous. You're blessed if someone persecutes you for being my disciple. You know, whoa. I mean, who do you think you are that you would say something like that? So he is actually setting himself up in a very high place with something like that. But secondly, I may be wrong about this, but this is what I have read before, and it makes sense that it would be true, is that when you look at the way that the rabbis conducted these sort of discussions, because there's a lot of discussion, you know, like on divorce and that kind of stuff, a lot of debate back and forth on, you know, what's this stuff supposed to look like. Those debates oftentimes involved appealing to other authorities. Well, you know, Hillel says, or Gamaliel says, or something like that. Whereas Jesus is coming along and not paying any attention to that stuff at all. He's just saying, let me tell you how it is. And so that authority that he's claiming here is at least basically my understanding of the authoritative scriptures is such that it is so right that I don't even really have to appeal to any authority or anything. I just know it, and this, let me tell you how it is. So I guess it's not, that word subjective is not entirely subjective. It's very much rooted in what somebody, you know, there's that time where the question of which are the greatest commandments comes up, and sometimes with that question, the Pharisee that's talking to Jesus will give that answer as well. I mean, they agree with that. It's not that Jesus is coming along and giving new information. You didn't know this before, but two great commandments are to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. They actually would say, you know, right. You got it right. That's exactly right, Jesus. Those are the two greatest commandments. So it's not that his authority as the Messiah is coming along and giving new information, but he is speaking authoritatively in the sense that that he's saying, it's kind of like, thus says the Lord, I'm just right. This is the way it is. I'm not even going to bother to argue with you about it. This is the way it is. So in that sense, a great authority, seems to me. Okay, well, thanks. Nice to see you all.